to panic, no need to get scared. You can make the future by being prepared. Hello, welcome to This Is How It Starts. My name is Amy Stubland, and thanks again for taking the time to hit play. When I first started the series, I said I'd be taking the lid off my own life experiences. And so far, that's meant bringing you guests that I've worked with or other creative people that I respect and have inspired or enriched my own life in some way. This episode is going to get a bit more personal. Back in 2021, athletes Naomi Osaka and Simone Biles were making headlines because they were prioritizing their physical and mental health over their careers, and what I must imagine were the crippling expectations put on them by the media and the sporting industry. Their brave rejection of toxic productivity and rise and grind culture took me back to one of the highest points of my career and also my lowest, when the work that I loved led to a mysterious disorder that resulted in the loss of function in my dominant hand. That included being able to draw and pretty much anything else. It's been over a decade since that life-changing experience. Inspired by the courage of those two women, I first wrote a personal piece on LinkedIn about the downside of hustle culture. But in this time with you, I wanted to walk you through the more personal parts of my journey, from the onset of my disorder and losing the use of my drawing hand through the difficult years I spent fighting, failing, and finding myself. Then later on in the podcast, physical therapist Dr. Chelsea Richardson will be joining us. Now, she's been helping me make sense of this disorder and helping me rehabilitate my brain and helping me find a new path forward. So stay tuned, there's lots coming up in this episode of This Is How It Starts. Now, just to set the stage here, I was almost a decade into my career in Detroit when, after a series of teaching and production jobs, and sometimes working those jobs all at the same time, I moved to California and landed my dream job working with the creative team making retail and concert apparel for some of the biggest names in music. Now, growing up, I'd always wanted to design album covers, but this was the music industry in the early 2000s, and album covers had become tiny digital thumbnails, so t-shirts seemed like the next best thing. During that first year, our workload quickly grew. I took on additional design responsibilities right out of the gate. Ironically, I found out some years later that when I had applied for that position, the hiring manager had scribbled too much design on the back of my resume. In just those first 2 years, I designed and developed several successful product lines that made headlines and helped the company and their clients make millions. I became the youngest director at the company. Over the next few years, the workload and pressure continued to grow, and I started experiencing a lot of pain and stiffness in my hand and forearm. I guess I just thought it would pass, and I felt like I just had to push through for my team and for my clients. Unfortunately, the pain just got worse. And I started to notice that as I would draw or sketch, my hand became sluggish and my fingers would lock up and my strokes wouldn't land where I intended them. Again, at first, I just thought maybe I was going too fast and not paying attention, but the more I really focused, the more it didn't even feel like my own hand. Imagine you're trying to play one of those first-person shooter games and you've got your enemy firmly in the crosshairs, but no matter what you do, all your shots veer to the side, just missing your target. Something is definitely not calibrated right, and the more you fight it, the worse it gets. Sometimes it felt as if there was a giant rubber band running up through my forearm to each one of my fingers, and someone was violently plucking it. The sensation was so intense and so painful, it forced my hand and fingers to curl into a sort of twisted claw. At times, my forearm felt so tight, I thought it might burst. For a while, I wore a $10 wrist brace from the drugstore to try to minimize the curl of my wrist. And when the tightness in my forearm and fingers became unbearable, I seemed to have developed this involuntary tic of shaking out my hand to ease the tension. And this made me very self-conscious. Afraid of being labeled difficult, lazy, or incompetent, I quickly learned to adapt and find shortcuts to hide the fact that something was wrong. For instance, I redistributed as much of the production work as I could to my left hand, saving my right for a few precious pain-free moments of detailed work. For day-to-day living, I would often use my feet and shoulders to open doors and forget about having a nice hairstyle.
Things like doorknobs and shoelaces became my mortal enemies. But there finally came a point where I was working through blurry, tear-filled eyes at my desk most afternoons, and for a woman in the workplace, often having to work twice as hard just to be seen as competent, the biggest sin you can commit is showing emotion or crying in the office. So I was more afraid I wouldn't be able to hide it anymore, and I finally decided to quietly talk to my supervisor about it. He was as supportive as he could be, but once I was directed to HR, things went from bad to worse. My situation was mostly tolerated because it was the law, and they had to allow me some time to rest and visit the doctor, but the contempt came through loud and clear. I heard things like, "Why didn't you just stop before it got so bad? Can't you just use your other hand?" And this is the one that got me the most. "You should act more like a smoker and take more breaks." And then the workers' compensation nightmare began. Now, you have to understand the level of whiplash I was experiencing here. I had just been named Employee of the Year and Hardest Working Employee the year before that. Now I'm an annoyance at work, and I'm being accused by my insurance caseworker of malingering and fraud. I'd sit in doctor's offices where they would look at me for 5 minutes and then try to suggest that this was all in my head and that I was somehow doing this to myself. I absolutely loved my work. Didn't always agree with the practices and the decisions of the company, but I loved my team and I loved what I do. The insinuation that I was sabotaging my own work and career after working so hard made no sense to me. It was insulting and hurtful. I went through a battery of medical tests, some mechanical, some neurological, but everything kept coming back normal. The doctors remained baffled, and all I knew was that this was far from normal. In the midst of managing all those external forces surrounding this mysterious injury, the internal forces of grief, anger, and fear also weighed down on me. How will I take care of myself? How will I make a living? Who even am I without the use of my hand, without my art? Drawing had always been my refuge growing up. It was fun for me, and it allowed me an escape from a home life that wasn't always so loving or nurturing. I was fortunate to have had a high school teacher who believed in my talents and even helped co-sign a car lease for me so I could get to all my jobs. I was pretty much on my own at 18, and college was just not in the cards for me, so I sort of had to put all my eggs in this one basket as a means of survival. I had worked so hard pursuing every other available opportunity and paying my dues to build my career, and now it was just gone. On top of everything else, there was also some intense personal relationship stuff going on. Now, I'll spare you the boring details, but I'll just share that in the middle of this complete breakdown of my entire identity and eventually my 13-year relationship, I had no other choice but to slow down and finally listen to my own heart, which allowed me to finally come to terms with the fact that I was gay. After eventually losing my job due to a company acquisition and enduring all the delays and mistreatment from the workers' comp situation, I just emotionally shut down and closed my case just to end the additional pain and trauma of being dismissed, ignored, and criticized for simply trying to get some help. I came to the realization that it would be solely up to me to rebuild a completely new life for myself, one that now included these physical limitations. Our society can be very strange. On the one hand, you know, we're told that we all bear personal responsibility for our lot in life and how we react to adversity, you know, bootstraps, right? On the other, if you haven't completely melted into the fetal position, unable to function at all, then you haven't been traumatized or sufficiently suffered enough for anyone to help you out. So it felt like this was the difficult crossroads that I found myself stuck at. Stop everything and try to mend properly for as long as it takes without a safety net, or push through and prioritize self-sufficiency at the risk of additional harm. Now, not to be dramatic, but I felt that if I had let things completely fall apart, I might not have recovered. For better or for worse, I tried to use the downtime and a bit of my hard-earned savings to keep my head above water and to try to find some new and positive experiences that didn't involve using my hands. somewhere in between pumping the brakes and pushing through, I had some adventures. For instance, I went on a 2-week tour of the Southwest with Los Angeles-based rock band Killola, whom I'd met through our mutual friend Arlen Hamilton, who is now making financial headlines in the venture capital industry as the founder of Backstage Capital. Shout out to Arlen. They needed someone to run the merchandise stand for their upcoming tour, and I had nothing but time. Now, bear in mind that my right hand was basically a hook at this point, so the guys in the band graciously helped me every night by lugging the t-shirt boxes in and out of the vehicle while I set up the stand and managed the transactions while they were on stage. During those few weeks, I remember being so moved by their resourcefulness and dedication. We drove from city to city, sometimes on the road for 6-8 hours at a time, just so they could be on stage that night for maybe 30 minutes. And during what little downtime there was, they were online, engaging with their dedicated fan base, doing vocal warm-ups, or tuning the equipment. It was a fascinating look into the life of a small indie band on tour. Then there was the time that I was supporting a friend who was trying to get out of an abusive relationship, so I went along with her for moral support to this meditation community that offered courses and personal development. And I ended up on the fringes of a group that turned out to be an alleged sex cult. Enough said. I tried a bit of salsa and blues dancing, which I enjoyed very much, but still had to be careful because it is a partner activity and it still involves your hands and your arms. Probably one of the most impactful moments was when I was introduced to roller skating. I loved the music and the freedom of the moves I saw people doing out there on the rink. So with a pair of skates that were gifted to me, I would spend hours practicing at the rink or any basketball or tennis court that wouldn't kick me out. It also opened my world up to an incredible history of Black roller skating culture and music. Growing up in Detroit, the home of Motown, I'd always been a big music lover. And now this love for skating had led to an amazing opportunity to combine them both as a guest DJ at San Francisco's famous roller disco, the Church of Eight Wheels. With my own musical background combined with what I'd learned from this incredible community of skaters, I earned a bit of a reputation for curating more authentic sets, specializing in the old school soul, funk, and R&B that I loved so much, instead of what I found to be corny wedding DJ sets that tended to cater to white audiences. I came to be known as White Chocolate, a nickname given to me by the community. Between the movement and the music, roller skating had provided another means of creative expression, this time, feet first. I also did quite a bit of reading during this time. I read memoirs and self-help books. I eventually came across a book called Musicophilia by Oliver Sacks. He was a neurologist who was famously played by the late Robin Williams in the 1990 movie Awakenings. Now, about 3/4 of the way through the book, I came across this chapter about a piano player that sounded precisely like my own symptoms and situation. This was the first time I would encounter the term focal dystonia, but a true diagnosis and treatment was still about a decade away. In terms of my more traditional creative endeavors, I would experience wild fluctuations between repulsion to any visual art and an intense desire to bring forth the ideas and images still swirling around in my head. At times, I rejected visual artwork completely, throwing myself into hours of left-handed writing drills. I tried to learn blues piano so I could figure out all the left-hand bass riffs from popular songs I loved. Out of boredom, I even tried my hand at making silly videos. With my little Sony SuperShot digital camera, I made goofy videos of my very patient cats, Quincy and Mingus, set to various bits of music. Let's call it the prehistoric version of TikTok. Other times, I'd feel a strong gravitational pull back to my craft. I experimented with digital tools and software, left-handed drawing techniques, sometimes even double-handed techniques. I also played with different art styles, loose and sketchy styles, sharp digital shapes. Sometimes I even did some abstract finger painting. But at this point, my work mostly consisted of terrible sketches, which I took to the computer to clean up and do all of the fine tuning. This is the part that nearly drove me insane. Things that used to take me a few minutes now took me hours or even days to finish. In one regrettable episode of stubbornness, along with mounting financial pressure, I put myself through excruciating pain to illustrate a book about a practice called orgasmic meditation. Yikes. When I finally found a local resource for assistance, the Department of Disability sent me to a 4-week career class at the community college to hopefully give me a better idea of what new career might work for me based on my interests, personality, and skills. When all the data was tabulated and all the numbers crunched, guess which career they recommended? You guessed it. Graphic design, multimedia, visual artist. I knew from my experimentations that with some flexibility and some time, I could still produce great work. But it was now my inability to work fast, which put me at a great disadvantage in a fiercely competitive job market for artists. I eventually restarted my career as a project manager for a creative services team overseeing the creation of hundreds of pieces of video game packaging. A big step back from where I was before, but I was just grateful to be back in the creative space, and it was kind of similar to making album covers, just for video games. It was really hard to have to restart my career all over again. I had all the knowledge and experience that was in my head, but demonstrating that value would be a tremendous challenge during this rebuilding process. Being back at work also came with the daily tasks of grooming, dressing, eating in public, and navigating spaces, which was much more difficult now. Sometimes I'd be exhausted by the time I got to the office in the morning. Starting a job and meeting new people meant that I was still very self-conscious that my so-called hidden disability was not so hidden. Little did I know that everything I was doing to appear more quote unquote normal was only reinforcing my condition. In the years that followed, I started to experience a lot of pain in my neck. I thought maybe it was just bad posture and 20 something years working behind a desk was finally taking its toll. And being that I was in my 30s at this point, if I hadn't been able to straighten myself out by now, I was going to need some help. So during a routine checkup, I mentioned it to my doctor. I figured it might be relevant, so I mentioned the issue with my hand and how I'd previously gone through this workers' comp process, but never actually received any treatment. The doctor stopped me immediately and said legally, they can't even talk to me about a previous workers' comp case. I was absolutely stunned. I mean, what if I had previously lost a toe or something and years later it became infected? Could the doctor actually just send me away without looking at it or treating it? It made no sense to me. This would happen once more with another doctor whom I barely managed to convince to refer me to a physical therapist, but I let the referral lapse and completely withdrew, convinced I was just setting myself up for another round of needless ridicule. Inside, I vowed never to speak of my pain again. Now, just a few years ago, in an unfortunate bit of irony, my wife would hurt her back from a fall and ended up in a physical therapist's office herself. Over the course of her own treatment, my wife mentioned to her therapist about my neck pain, my hand issue, and everything that I had dealt with over the years. And this sweet angel woman suggested to my wife that I make an appointment and she would take a look for herself. By the end of that first consultation, she had already identified that my neck problem was likely a result of years of poor body mechanics stemming from all the ways that I had adapted my body and movements to compensate for the loss of my hand. She was the first person to believe me and didn't hesitate to help me at all. During the course of that treatment, I hadn't realized the amount of mobility I had actually lost in my neck, shoulders, and arms. I'd always been pretty active, so it scared me a bit. But over the next year or so, she would help me strengthen and stabilize my neck, enabling me to just hold it on my own shoulders properly. Still, we were left with the underlying problem of my hand. She went above and beyond to take the time to come with me to another doctor so that she could explain exactly what she was seeing from a clinical point of view. The whole process took a while because doctors seemed to be constantly changing medical networks, but she was determined and she helped me assemble a brand new team, including a neurologist and another therapist who specializes in functional movement disorders. In 2019, after an MRI ruled out MS, I was finally diagnosed with task-specific focal dystonia. I want to take a moment to thank that therapist. Her name is Lisa Green, owner of Pacific Therex Physical Therapy Sports Medicine and Fitness. The level of care and dignity she showed me was beyond what I could have ever imagined, and I will forever be grateful for her expertise and the level of treatment I received from her. Well, I guess that brings us to present day. So now that you've heard a bit of my personal journey, physical therapist Dr. Chelsea Richardson will join us in just a minute to walk us through all the nerdy and fascinating details of this disorder so we can fully understand what happened to me. What is this focal dystonia? And what's the path forward? Now, before we dive in, just a bit of a disclaimer. This conversation is presented for informational purposes only. So please talk to your own doctor if you think you might have any of these issues. But hoping we can shed some light on this interesting issue today. So with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Richardson. It's great to have you here today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Amy. This is great.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your bio and your area of expertise?
Yeah. So I have my clinical doctorate in physical therapy, and I'm also a board certified neurologic clinical physical therapist. So that means I got an extra board certification just to specialize in working with people with neurologic conditions. And my passion and kind of area of clinical interest is movement disorders. So this is like my jam. I'm a nerd for movement disorders. And I actually did an additional year of clinical training in a movement disorders fellowship with Reactive Physical Therapy and UCLA. So this is my jam. I'm excited to talk about it.
Excellent. So you and I have been working together for about the last year or so, working through what's been going on with me for the last decade and trying to retrain my brain and untangle all these tangles. But first, I want to talk about exactly what are these tangles and what is this all about? So for the average Joe like me, can you help define this focal dystonia for us? And what exactly is happening between my brain and my hand?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. I think it helps to think of dystonia as an umbrella term. So dystonia is a movement disorder that's characterized by abnormal co-contractions of what we call antagonist muscles. So muscles that should be working opposite of one another are now working together, and they shouldn't be. So this is an abnormal involuntary contraction of muscles. And it can cause, you know, either sustained postures or, you know, sometimes tremors, impaired motor control. But within that umbrella is this really unique, part of dystonia, which is focal dystonia. And that is where the dystonia affects one particular region of the body. And specifically, it happens to be with specific tasks, most traditionally. So you've probably heard of writer's cramp. That is a focal dystonia. Musicians often develop dystonia, and it can happen to people who are practicing very skilled repetitive motions. We also see people get runner's dystonia in an area of their body. So it's a really fascinating clinical presentation, but It is a little still unknown within the clinical literature what causes this abnormal movement. We know some things, but we're still uncovering a lot within the literature.
Got it. So there isn't any one specific thing that causes it. It's not necessarily a genetic disposition. Are there any other cause factors that are still in question?
Yeah, there are some genetic forms of dystonia. They have identified certain genes. Those tend to be more of the generalized dystonia, meaning that they're affecting more than one body part. And those tend to run in families. But the kind of idiopathic focal dystonia, where somebody might be experiencing just this abnormal movement in one area of their body, yeah, we have some clues, some hints. One is having this very precise repetitive motion tends to be a predisposing factor, but there's been some signs within the literature that there's also some abnormal sensory motor integration, and I can break that down a little bit, as well as some things going on in the brain that are like super cool and nerdy, like you said, where people who end up developing dystonia actually have like two plastic brains. It's called maladaptive neuroplasticity. So their brains are actually too good at developing a new motor pattern, and it ends up creating something that they maybe didn't intend in the first place. So you kind of get this perfect storm of, you know, this skilled repetitive motion combined with abnormal sensory motor integration, and then this like brain that is really good at plasticity and change. And then that creates our dystonia. That's kind of our best guess as to what's going on.
Got it. Is there a simple, the semi-simple way of breaking down, like literally what is happening between the hand and the brain?
Yeah. So I like to think of it as like a software issue. I kind of like the analogy of like software versus hardware. So if you think of the nervous system as a combination of software and hardware, right? The hardware is like the nerves themselves. If you have a stroke, for example, the hardware itself is damaged. But in something like dystonia, it's really a software glitch where the areas of the brain that are trying to communicate the signals down to an area of the body are just not firing or regulating in the same way that they used to. And it tends to happen with these very unique movements. It doesn't happen with everything because there's not a damage in the hardware. It's truly the software that's kind of malfunctioning.
Right. So there's, I guess you could say there, so there's nothing literally wrong with my hand. It's the software driving it.
Right. And many people with, you know, dystonia first seek out, you know, a physical therapist or an orthopedist, you know, to tell them, you know, I have pain or I'm having some muscle weakness. And they think it truly is happening at the tissue level. And what we've found is that there's really not anything happening at the tissue level. It's coming from the signals down from the brain to the actual tissues where there's the disruption.
When I think about this software analogy, one of the most wild things that I learned from working with you was that I did not have the ability to distinguish right and left hands. You know, we had this app that you showed me and I would look at a hand and just absolutely short out. I could see that it was a hand, but left or right, just my brain just short circuited. So, I mean, that really does feel like it, you know, connects to that software analogy. And then one of the other things with this was this notion that if I watch somebody's hand in, you know, a similar position, you know, we would look at some YouTube videos or, you know, I watched something on TV that had me in tears because, you know, it was just so triggering just to watch somebody else's hand. What's going on there?
Yeah. So it's a really fascinating concept. To kind of break it down, our brains have a map of our bodies within both the motor and the sensory cortexes. So this map actually is called the homunculus, which is my favorite word. If I were going to be a DJ, I would be DJ homunculus. It stands for, I think it's Latin for like little man, but really it's because the like brain lays out the body parts in this kind of topographical map. And what we find in people with dystonia is that sensory and motor cortex map is a little smudged. So the area that represents the part of the body, you know, for example, in your case, the hand, right? It might not be as crisp as it used to be. There might be some cortical smudging is kind of the term we use. And therefore, when our brain tries to either activate that area of the body or even visualizes what that area of the body might look like, because it's not a clear picture, it can be really difficult to differentiate and to activate the right areas of the brain. So part of the treatment is getting that sensory and motor area more crisp through some of these treatments. So one of them is like you said, this idea of laterality. So when we look at pictures of an object, whenever there's been, you know, either longstanding pain or longstanding changes like dystonia, it can be difficult for our nervous system to identify a right hand or a left hand. And so the more we practice, the more that cortex, that area of the sensory and motor part of the brain gets crisp again. So then hopefully you're able to activate the right things at the right time. So maybe that's activating one finger versus activating all the hand, for example.
It's funny when you said map, it also made me think of like early on when the onset of this was kind of happening, there would be this way that I would, and I talked about it earlier in the podcast, but I would go to make a drawing or make a stroke and it would land not where I put it. So again, I feel like that really is like, yeah, the map is distorted. And so it's not landing where I think it should. It's landing in this smudged area, so to speak. So right.
Yeah. And, you know, our body is constantly recreating that sensory and motor map. You know, if you, like, for example, like put on a watch for a while and then you take it off and you have that feeling that the watch is still there, that is your sensory homunculus, because it actually became a part of your picture, your brain's picture of what is a part of that wrist. So it's constantly changing. And in dystonia, if there's some abnormal sensory and motor connection, conversation, then it gets a little distorted. So yeah, exactly. You might not know where your hand is in space. So that's why when you landed, you might land a completely different place than you intended.
You actually started to talk about how there are treatments for sort of rewiring the brain. Some treatments call for Botox injections and things like that. That hasn't been my particular path. I've definitely gone more towards this, and correct me if I'm wrong with the terminology, but just more of the sensory retraining. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about some of those different exercises?
You're right. There are some medical treatments for dystonia, but actually there's been a growing breadth of literature in physical therapy, particularly led by Nancy Beal, who is a researcher at UCSF, who started working in people like you with focal hand dystonia on this idea of learning-based sensory motor retraining. And it kind of has three pillars of treatment. And that's the kind of the approach that, you know, I tend to take when I'm working with clients with dystonias. The first is kind of setting the brain up for change. And, you know, we know that people with dystonia have really adaptive brains. So we want to set them up for success. So the first thing is promoting inhibition. So this is because they found in people with dystonia that their brain has a lack of inhibition. So it's sending signals all the time. And our brain naturally has this mix of excitatory and inhibitory signals. And if you can imagine, if you just have all in, you know, excitatory signals, you're going to get overflow of this contraction, right? And so if we can set the brain up for some inhibition through some mindfulness techniques, through some breathing techniques, sometimes that's aerobic exercise. It kind of depends on the person, but that sets the brain up for change and promotes some inhibition. The second pillar is sensory. You like hit the nail on the head. We know that there's this mismatch in people with dystonia of sensory information and motor output. And if we change the sensory experience, so like with you, we've like had your hand behind a mirror. We've had you holding pens that are on, you know, covered in a noodle. We've had you, you know, change the experience in a sensory way so much that it actually requires your nervous system to recruit a different motor pattern. So that's kind of the second pillar, is capitalize on sensory inputs. Mm-hmm. And then the third is actually retraining these movements. So once you start to incorporate, you know, the sensory training into everyday life, and you start to, you know, really practice these new motor patterns, they start to become more automatic.
Right.
So that's one treatment approach for working with people with dystonia.
Yeah. So just to take a step back, the first time I heard this term focal dystonia was in the book Musicophilia, where neurologist Oliver Sacks was telling the story of a piano player whose story sounded a lot like what I was going through. And now, all these years later, there's this TED talk where this gentleman was dealing with cervical dystonia and had discovered dance as a way to deal with his symptoms. Have you seen this? Are you familiar with this video?
Oh, yeah. I work with a lot of people with cervical dystonia. Yeah.
So for me, that was the next big moment where this is being talked about in a space that's a little bit more mainstream. And so one of the things that came up in my own personal treatment was what I think you have referred to as sort of finding joy in movement. And for me, that came in the form of basketball. So this was something I enjoyed as a kid and was semi-good at it. And heck, I thought I was going to be a Harlem Globetrotter when I was a kid. And there was just something in me a few months ago where I was struggling to get back into exercising. And on a bit of a whim, I ordered this basketball and I just started messing around with it. And it turned out that it opened up a lot of interesting things for me with my hand. All that to say is, I'm curious if you can share any other thoughts about this concept of, you know, finding joy in movement And what are some of the findings you're seeing in relation to that?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And you're right. This is something that I see so much in my clients with dystonia, that there can be this loss. And many of them grieve the loss of joyful activities. Dystonia can take away a lot. And, you know, for some professions, right, if you're working with a musician and they can't, you know, perform anymore, that's a huge loss.
It's devastating. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, what we've found is actually, you know, I think people with dystonia are so rightfully concerned to make their dystonia worse by, you know, performing activities where they might experience the dystonia. So part of treatment with, you know, somebody who really understands dystonia is finding ways to adapt that movement so that you can begin to perform joyful movement again, because that actually sets the brain up for change in so many ways. There's like a million neurotransmitters that get released when we perform joyful movement, and that actually promotes motor learning. So we actually learn better when we're excited, when we're, you know, enjoying the activity. And then the other thing, I love that this person was doing a TED talk on dance. You know, a lot of, you know, dance, basketball, something that is kind of an externally focused, goal-oriented task, it's been shown to really improve automaticity of movement. So allowing our brain to automatically access the pathways that we have, right? So if we're thinking that this is just a software issue rather than a hardware issue, the, you know, goal-oriented and the externally focused tasks actually unlock some of that potential, right, for normal movement. And the more you practice it, the more you solidify those pathways. So I was like thrilled when you were like, yeah, my basketball, and we were dribbling. And you're right, your hand is much more relaxed when you're, you know, just enjoying playing basketball than when you're trying to, you know, move your hand volitionally. And the goal would be over time that you could kind of take those joyful activities into other movements. But yeah, it's really fascinating. I really try to encourage a lot of my clients with dystonia that, you know, getting back to joy, it should be a part of our treatment plan. You know, even if you have some dystonia, it's okay. It's not the end of the world. But even if you have 10% less dystonia with like a sensory input that's changed, that's great. So yeah, it's a big part of treatment. And I think it's really important for the brain.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're not necessarily at the point where, you know, I'm drawing and writing again normally, but I was definitely really pleased to kind of watch my hand unfold literally, you know, at the sight of a basketball. I mean, that was just so, the brain is a magnificent organ for sure.
It is. It is.
Yeah. Yeah. So, so I'm looking forward, you know, to what's next, but, that really felt like a turning point for me in my treatment, finding something that I enjoyed doing, unlocked something for me. So I'm looking forward to pulling that thread and see where it goes. So, being in the medical profession, or I guess being in the medical community, do you think doctors are now more aware of this issue than perhaps a decade ago?
Yes and no. I definitely think there's more evidence out there. I think the challenge with the medical system is that everything is so siloed. The people who really specialize in dystonia and movement disorders are specifically movement disorder specialist neurologists. And so it can take people a long time to even get to the right person who can make that diagnosis. My hope is that, you know, we as physical therapists, if we can spread knowledge about these movement disorders and help somebody who maybe isn't even in the neurologic physical therapy realm, maybe they see athletes, maybe they are working with, you know, just standard outpatient orthopedics population, that they could actually identify this and get that person to the right, you know, resources so that they can access treatment faster. Because what we really do know is that, you know, the quicker you can get some resources, the easier the treatment can be. It doesn't necessarily mean that you won't achieve, you know, changes. I've seen people, you know, 20 years into their dystonia journey and still making changes. So the brain is always plastic. But to kind of circle back to your question, I think it's definitely a challenge within our medical system. I think most people end up seeing, you know, either their general practitioner or a general neurologist who, you know, might be able to screen for some of these things, but hopefully they'll be able to revert people to movement disorder specialists who can really provide that diagnosis.
Yeah. I'm hoping we're on the right track, because as people will have heard earlier in the podcast, my particular experience was I went from employee of the year at the peak of my career to sitting in doctor's office and having them tell me that this is all in my head and I'm doing this to myself. That was really, really difficult part of my journey with this. Is there anything that you might recommend that somebody who was sitting in my position 10 years ago could do?
Yeah. I mean, wow. I think, Amy, first of all, I want to like validate how traumatizing that experience must have been. And you're so not alone that, you know, most of the clients who come to Reactive have had an experience where they've been told, this is just stress, or this is all in your head, or you just need to see a psychologist. And it's just, it boggles my mind, because the literature just does not show that. The literature shows that this is so real and so valid. So just first want to validate that for you. But I think now the one beauty of the internet, I know there's a lot of challenges with the internet,
sure,
is that there are more ways to actually access other people who have dystonia. And what I've found is that other people with dystonia are creating networks and are reaching out to resources. And it can be a really positive way to find people who actually know what this disorder is and can give you either a second opinion or can recommend treatment for you. And I think if, you know, if anyone's listening to this and they're experiencing what they think is dystonia, I would recommend talking with their primary care physician or their neurologist and asking for a referral to a movement disorder specialist, because those people tend to be the most validating and understanding of this diagnosis and are able to actually provide some affirmative treatment. But I think the internet is great. We've had people all over the world be able to find, you know, Reactive at least. And, you know, even if we can't treat them all over the world, we can give them resources. We can connect them to physical therapists in their area. So I think if you can access some a community, it can be really helpful to get a little bit more resources and to be affirmed that you're not alone.
That's great. Thank you for that, that insight. I think I'm hoping, you know, that's what we'll accomplish with today's discussion, that perhaps someone won't have to struggle for a decade before finding some help. So yeah, hopefully again, if you know, you're listening to this and any of this sounds familiar, hopefully there's some information here for you. Is there anything else we should know about this or about treatment, or maybe if anybody wanting to look into this further as a career or something?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think in terms of dystonia, I just want to like have people know that recovery is possible. You know, I wish I could look into a crystal ball and tell everybody when they would get
right
the recovery they're looking for. But yeah, the brain is just fantastic and able to change. And given the right inputs, it can make new changes. So that's the first thing. And then, yeah, I mean, if you're out there and you're interested in dystonia, I mean, I know I actually in college was really interested in physical therapy, but, you know, my uncle had Parkinson's disease. And then one of my classmates who I went to college with had a, you know, genetic generalized dystonia. And I was like, wow, what is going on? I really want to understand this. And when I got to physical therapy school and I met Julie Hirschberg, who was my professor, she did one little slide talk about dystonia. And I was hooked. And I was like, I have to come to your clinic so that I can learn more and I can, you know, understand how to help people with this condition. So if you're interested at all in, you know, the nervous system and in the brain, you can, you know, reach out to me personally. You can reach out to Reactive. We love talking to fellow neuro nerds out there. I would highly encourage, you know, anyone who's interested in physical therapy. It's a great career. And, you know, when I got into physical therapy, I don't think I knew how impactful it could be. And that you could kind of specialize in these unique areas where you really get to help people make changes in their brain. So just a little plug for the physical therapy profession.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, like I said, when I finished that musicophilia book, I almost made a career change. The brain is fascinating. I was like, wow, this is interesting stuff. I wouldn't mind learning more. So yeah, very cool. Dr. Chelsea Richardson, thank you so much for your time here today, sharing your expertise with us and helping us make sense of all this. It was so great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Amy. I'm so honored. And you are just a total boss. And I'm so proud of you and all that you do. So thank you for including me. And I'm super honored to be here.
And that was the final and most personal episode in this limited series podcast. I hope you found the brain as fascinating as I did, and perhaps my story can serve as a bit of a cautionary tale so that you can take a different course and avoid injury or burnout. Your personal fulfillment and value is not tied to how many hours you work, how many drawings you draw, how many widgets you produce, or how many jerks you tolerate. I'd like you to know that you are enough just as you are. At the top of the program, you heard this little jingle that probably no one under 40 remembers. It was from a series of Saturday morning cartoon PSAs called Zach of All Trades, and Zach would battle this future blob to help kids start thinking about a career. Now, given the current state of capitalism in the United States right now, there's a lot to unpack there. However, I included it here because that thing stuck with me over the years. For much of that difficult time in my life, I too felt like I was fighting that future blob. In any case, the coolest part about that clip is that the voice of Zach was none other than legendary singer Luther Vandross. So if you were wondering, that's where that came from. For more resources on physical therapy or focal dystonia, you can visit Reactive Physical Therapy and Wellness online at reactivept.com, which is reactivept.com, or check the link in the podcast description. As always, you can find me at amiebruckner.com. That's AimeeBruckner.com. Well, that's all, folks. I hope you enjoyed this series and can take a moment to rate and review it. Feel free to comment about a topic you'd like me to cover, and perhaps I'll pick it up in a future series. Until then, thank you so much once again for tuning into This Is How It Starts with Amy Steplin.